The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're exploring the science of the ultimate criminal punishment. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. This week, we're looking at the sometimes disturbing science associated with the practice and impact of capital punishment. A little later on, we'll talk to law professor Samuel Gross about a statistical method to estimate the number of inmates in the United States who are on death row for crimes they didn't commit. We'll also speak with psychiatrist Dr. James C. Harris about the complex issues that arise when people with intellectual disabilities are sentenced to die. But first, we're going to talk about the use and all too frequent misuse of the drugs that make up a lethal injection. My first guest is David Kroll, a pharmacologist and public science communications evangelist, currently serving as an adjunct associate professor of English at North Carolina State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. David is a freelance science writer and a regular contributor at Forbes.com, and we are very pleased to have him back on the show.
And
hello
I'm
again,
delighted.
The lovely to have you here. Not for a very, it's a very depressing reason, I have to say. Execution drugs. They have been a hot topic recently. Why is that? Let's start there.
Yeah, it is sad for me too to have to talk about this today. But I'm trained as a pharmacologist and a toxicologist, so I know about the bad side effects of drugs. And unfortunately, in the case of capital punishment in the United States, these drugs are being used for their lethal effects. But the reason that this is timely is there has been an issue with accessibility to intravenous drugs that are used in carrying out capital punishment in the U.S. and going back through history, the way this all started in the 1980s was a medical examiner in Oklahoma proposed lethal injection as a way of executing prisoners convicted of egregious crimes with these drugs, as opposed to the electric chair, or in certain cases, like in Utah, shooting by a firing squad. So we're pretty barbaric people down here. And what has happened was the Oklahoma medical examiner proposed the use of a barbiturate called sodium thiopental. And thiopental is a drug that had been used in surgeries to put people to sleep very rapidly and is then followed by an inhaled anesthetic. What has happened recently, I'd say probably in the last 4 years, is companies that have made thiopental have either discontinued making them simply because it's not used as much in surgery anymore, or overseas suppliers have stopped selling it to United States corrections departments as sort of a protest against our continued use of capital punishment. So with that said, Desiree, the issue currently is that different departments of correction around the United States have had to seek other drugs that, when combined, have a lethal effect. And what's sadly happening here is that these are experiments. The amounts of drugs being used are questionable. The types of drugs being used may not, I can't believe we're even saying this, but would execute a person humanely. And also, there have been cases, most recently in the state of Oklahoma, where a prisoner began to wake up during his execution, and a whole investigation has followed as to why that debacle occurred.
Well, there's a lot to break down here. So let's start with the fact that you said drugs, plural, mm-hmm. because a lethal injection actually requires more than one, right?
Right. So the combination that had been used, and this is also going to seem somewhat morbid, but this was actually a question given to me by my professor during my examination for progression to my PhD, again, because we had to know these sorts of things. And the question was, how do the drugs being used in capital punishment work? And so there are usually three drugs. One, as I mentioned, was the first drug, sodium thiopental, which is absolutely essential. And that is to cause unconsciousness. And then the other thing that the thiopental does is it also causes analgesic effects, meaning that the person cannot respond even by reflexes to pain. So a lot of us, when we're unconscious, if we prick our skin or something like that, reflexes through our spinal cord might actually cause us to move. And so that's a problem, obviously, if you're having surgery done. So you want to be able to have something that puts you to sleep and then also will decrease your responsiveness to a painful stimulus. Then the second drug that is used is a so-called neuromuscular blocking agent. And probably the first one that was used was a drug called succinylcholine. And these drugs are used to paralyze the muscles that control breathing. And these, again, are valuable drugs for their therapeutic effects to enable breathing tubes to be put down into your lungs when you're undergoing surgery or when you need artificial ventilation for some medical reason. So that's the second drug. The third drug, if you will, is actually a salt called potassium chloride. So it's a little bit like your table salt. In fact, some people actually you can buy potassium chloride now. As a salt substitute. So it's not sodium chloride, potassium chloride. And potassium is an ion that's in our bloodstream and in the fluid of our body that regulates our it's very tightly regulated, that controls our nerve conduction and our heartbeat. And an overdose of potassium chloride will cause the heart to essentially be paralyzed. So to recap, the first drug puts you to sleep and decreases any reflex reaction to painful stimulus. The middle drug paralyzes the respiratory muscles. And then the last drug paralyzes the heart.
Since we're being morbid, can you walk me through the progression, I guess, of the physical effects of a lethal injection?
You know, the way that I try to explain it to my students is to really step back and describe the reasons why you have each of the three drugs. Now, just let me say for a second that when we put a suffering animal to sleep, okay, so in the guidelines of veterinary associations of all different nations, you can simply just use a high dose of thiopental, the first drug, or any other drug in that class. And so like another one of them is phenobarbital, another one is pentobarbital. So that's really all that you need. The problem, I guess, for people in the corrections industry, if you will, is that it takes a while for that to cause death, anywhere on the order of 15 to 30 minutes. For whatever reason, in the U.S., they want the death to appear very clinical and rapid. And so for that reason, the thing that you have to do is you have to stop the heart from beating to deprive the rest of the body of oxygen. So if you were to just give potassium chloride, you would die in minutes, in some cases less than a minute. The problem is it would be incredibly painful. It would be like injecting fire through your veins. Okay, so that's the reason that the other two drugs have to be given, one to paralyze the respiratory muscles and the other one to just simply put you to sleep. But by and large, if you waited long enough, a high enough dose of the first drug, sodium thiopental, could cause death.
So you need all three drugs, or else it wouldn't be considered a humane execution then?
Sadly, yes. Now, but the problem that's come up is that, as I mentioned at the outset, sodium thiopental is no longer available. And it's still also difficult to get some of the barbiturate drugs. So a substitute that's been used is another drug called midazolam. And midazolam is a of the anti-anxiety class of drugs that's also used to introduce or to induce anesthesia. I just had some surgery on my nasal septum and my sinuses, and one of the first drugs I got was intravenous midazolam. What that does is it does cause unconsciousness, but in medical parlance, it is referred to as conscious sedation. So that should be a red flag to you already, conscious sedation. What that means is that while you may be appear to be unconscious, you can still have a response to painful stimuli. And so I don't know what people were thinking when they wanted to replace midazolam with replace sodium thiopental with midazolam. But it is a bad drug to be used together with the respiratory paralysis agent and the heart paralysis agent, because the risk you run, and as it occurred in Oklahoma, is that the condemned prisoner could certainly wake up during the execution.
But this is what prisons are faced with if they're trying to make do. As you said, they're sort of conducting their own little experiments at this mm-hmm. point.
Yeah, and they've pretty much tried to guess at the dose of midazolam to use, and I think they're sort of essentially shooting in the dark here. A few executions have been carried out successfully, but there have been these issues, and the way that some departments of correction are getting around the drug shortages, because now. Companies won't sell even midazolam directly to corrections authorities.
Oh, really?
Yes, yes. So the way that prisons are getting around it is to contract with a compounding pharmacist. And these are the pharmacists who actually make up individualized doses of drugs. I think you'll see it a lot for pediatric patients and for cancer patients who need, you know, very, very specifically dosed mm-hmm. drugs. So these people purchase the drug, and then they sell it to the corrections authorities. And interestingly enough, they sell it under conditions of anonymity, so no one can ever go back and look and you know protest or picket outside of a compounding pharmacy that they provided a drug for execution purposes.
Well, now, even when all of the required effective drugs are available, I understand that there are other things that can go wrong during a lethal injection.
Yes, and that gets into another aspect of the medical professionals that are involved in the execution of the execution, if you will. And that is the IV, so all these drugs are given intravenously. The vein has to be properly ported, or the needle has to be properly put into the vein. And physicians, by and large, are ethically bound not to be involved in this particular mm-hmm. step, and even nurses. So almost every regulating body of the health professions declares that it's unethical for a professional to be involved in executions. Recently, what states have done is have an emergency medical technician, a paramedic type person, start the IV, and these people are trained to do so. There's you know, obviously that you know this can be done, but in the case of the Oklahoma execution, an IV line could not be established, and they ultimately had to put it into this gentleman's femoral vein, which is down in the groin area. And it appears, even with that large vein, that the IV was put in incorrectly and the drugs never made it into the bloodstream. They just sort of diffused into the surrounding tissue and over time ultimately did cause him to die of cardiac arrest.
Are there people that these drugs just might not work on for whatever reason?
I think that the drugs at a high enough dose should cause death in most people. There are some considerations if individuals have a rapid metabolism of some of these drugs, like the midazolam. But that's more of an issue in the acute use of these drugs in surgery. You would consider these sorts of things. For an execution where you're using 10 and 50 and even 100 times higher than the therapeutic dose, people should not necessarily be differentially sensitive to these drugs, although, you know, there probably is a small window where there's, depending on if someone is very fat, perhaps, because many of these drugs diffuse into fat, depending on the weight of the person. To be honest, I don't know if the dose is adjusted based on whether you're 300 pounds or 120 pounds. So those are the kinds of other things that might play in to a lesser extent.
Well, I have to say, this whole conversation makes me spectacularly uncomfortable. Are you getting asked a lot of these questions lately, especially after your Forbes piece?
I do. I have been asked a lot of these questions, and I, you know, I personally have a bit of a mixed feeling about this. When I was in college, a friend of mine who I lived with had his girlfriend was murdered back in their hometown in northeastern Pennsylvania, and the gentleman who killed her was sentenced to execution, and has essentially been on death row for almost the last 30 years. And my own personal feelings have sort of vastly. I used to be pro capital punishment, of course, because I was so angry for my poor friend and his family and her family. But you know, over time, I've sort of watched that individual case, this guy, sort of go through the process, coming within hours of being executed one time. And I think of the millions of dollars that have been spent on appeals and all the different things associated with this. And it's at the point now where my buddy's girlfriend, her parents are no longer with us. So there's really not even a reason to pursue the execution for a sense of vengeance or whatever the family may still be feeling. And I think we know, if you talk to an economist, that the cost of keeping a person in prison for, say, 40 years, you know, until they die of natural causes, is less expensive than the cost it takes to go for a lethal injection. So I don't know. I mean, I think this is a horrible thing. Now I think that we have enough evidence that there is racial bias in terms of African Americans being disproportionately sentenced to death. I think we have seen enough cases where people have been falsely convicted, and that DNA evidence or other evidence has come to light today that shows that many individuals on death row were not the murderers. Once you execute someone, it's irreversible. Someone who's in prison for life, well, you can appeal that decision, and it can be reversed at some point.
You know, I think I like it much better when I'm asking you questions about getting high.
Yeah, I enjoy being interviewed much more about recreational drugs. In fact, I know this is very sad, and I'm sorry that I had to serve as your expert today.
No, but you a fantastic piece, and we are always thrilled to have you come on the show. Thanks very much for being here, David.
My pleasure, Desiree.
We've linked to pharmacologist David Kroll and his post about lethal injection drugs for Forbes.com on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. We'll be back with law professor Samuel Gross to talk about the statistics of capital convictions and exoneration right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. We're spending the hour exploring the thorny science of criminal sentencing and the death penalty. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined now by Samuel R. Gross, the Thomas and Mabel Long Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. Samuel is the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations, a joint project of the University of Michigan Law School and the Center on Wrongful Convictions at the Northwestern University School of Law, which maintains a detailed online database of all known exonerations in the United States since 1989. Welcome, Samuel.
Good to be here.
Now, you were part of a team of researchers that recently published a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that uses a statistical method to estimate how many death row inmates in America would be exonerated given enough time and attention. So before we start talking about that study, how were we estimating that prior to your research?
The best estimate before that probably was one that one of my co-authors, Barbara O'Brien, and I came up with, must be about 8 years ago now, that was a much simpler technique. Exonerations from death row in the United States take a while. They average about 10 years from the time of conviction. So if you just divide the number of exonerations that have occurred by the total number of death sentences, you get an underestimate, because there are a bunch of people who've been sentenced to death who might yet be exonerated, but who won't have been because they haven't been there long enough for the process to work its way through. So you can just look at cases that are old enough, cases that, as we did it, had been in the pipeline for at least 15 years at the time we looked at them. And for that group, we found that the rate of exoneration was 2.3% of all death sentences. But that's still an underestimate, because even so, there will be quite a few people who were innocent who were not exonerated and wouldn't be exonerated in any reasonable period of time. So that was our first attempt. We produced an estimate that we described as an undercount, but an initial estimate. And then we started searching around for statistical techniques to improve on it.
So that's a very rough estimate. What are the specific challenges that you're looking at when you're trying to figure out something like this?
The main ones that that you have in this context is the basic central one, is that the item that we're trying to measure, the innocence of people who are sentenced to death, is not something you can observe. You don't know whether someone is guilty or innocent. That's a judgment that's made. And in this context, it's a judgment which we know by now, we know unquestionably, that in a fair number of instances, the people who are responsible for making it make mistakes. So we use exonerations as a proxy for innocence, and it's a good proxy, but there will be some errors. Some of the people who are exonerated are probably guilty, and there will be some errors on the other side. Some of the people who are not exonerated will be innocent. So the challenge is to try to figure out how to make the best use of this proxy, exoneration, as a measure of the rate of innocence of those who are sentenced to death. The big problem is that the process that results in exonerations does not identify all of the people who are innocent who are sentenced to death. And that's what we were focused on. In some cases, it's just because there hasn't been enough time. For that, you can just wait, although that limits the amount of information you have. In other cases, it's because they will never be identified. And that's what led us to the technique which we employed. In general, in the United States and every place else, the number of people who are falsely convicted and exonerated is a small fraction of the total number of people who are falsely convicted. Most people who are innocent or convicted of serious criminal offenses never get identified, never get released, never get their names cleared. Death sentences appear to be different. The rate of exoneration among people sentenced to death in the United States is far higher than the rate of exoneration for any other crime. I mean, to give you one example, death sentences are about 1 or 2% of murder convictions in the United States, but something like 15% of exonerations in murder cases, which suggests a much higher rate of exoneration for death sentences. Unless you think that for some reason errors in capital cases are 10 or 15 or more times higher than they are in other murder cases, which seems implausible. The reason for this, the reason for the extremely high rate of exonerations in death cases, is pretty straightforward. we pay much more attention to cases of people who are sentenced to death after conviction. They get many more resources. They get much more attention from the courts. Prosecutors, judges, attorneys general are all much more willing to consider the possibility that someone who is sentenced to death might be innocent, and to pay attention to claims of innocence, and to reverse convictions and even release people, in large part because we're very afraid of the possibility of executing someone who's innocent. That creates a great deal of pressure to be very careful and generates resources that aren't available to other people. Defendants who are sentenced to death in the United States, with some exceptions, but not that many, almost all have lawyers from the time that they are sentenced to death until they leave death row by one means or another. Other people who are in prison in the United States almost never have lawyers. They have lawyers, if at all, for a very short period of time, and usually not ever. People under sentence of death have access to federal courts to review their convictions. That's almost never true of people who are not sentenced to death, and so on. The differences are very stark. And as a result, it's well known, we have well known cases of innocent people who have been exonerated and released, who, if they had not been sentenced to death, would almost certainly still be in prison and would probably die in prison, because they would never have gotten the attention and the consideration that is given to people who are under threat of execution. So that's the reason why we can do the study at all, because it appears to be the case that that a very large number, perhaps the great majority of innocent people who are sentenced to death, are in fact identified and exonerated. But it's not an even process. And that gets to the second step and what's distinctive about this study. The driving motor that generates this high rate of exoneration is the threat of execution. But most defendants who are sentenced to death in the United States are eventually resentenced to life imprisonment by one of half a dozen legal means, usually by courts. But in one manner or another, if you're sentenced to death in the United States, what will probably happen is after a period of 3 or 5 or 15 years, you'll be resentenced to life imprisonment and then live out your days in a prison cell, no longer under threat of execution. And once that happens, the high rate of exoneration that's peculiar to people who might be executed drops away, and the rate of execution goes down to a fraction of what it was while you were still on death row. So of the exonerations that we considered in our study, exonerations through 2004 for defendants who were sentenced to death between 1973 and 2004, we had 117 of those. 107 of them were exonerations by defendants who, at the time the exoneration process began, were still on death row under threat of execution, and only 10 were for defendants who had already left death row and no longer were under threat of being put to death by the state. So the question for us was, is there a way to use the information we have about life history of death cases after conviction to focus in on that process, not the total process of exoneration of people sentenced to death, but the specific process of exonerations for defendants who might still be executed, those who are under threat of execution, and see what the rate of execution is when you face that threat, because that process is the one that comes close to identifying all of the innocent defendants who have been sentenced to death. And it turns out that there's a statistical technique that is very commonly used in medicine, survival analysis, that does exactly this. And that's what we did. We used this technique that's borrowed from epidemiology to estimate the rate at which defendants who were sentenced to death in the United States in that period, 1973 through 2004, would be exonerated if they all remained on death row under threat of death for at least 21.6 years. And that produced the estimate that was published, 4.1%.
So 4.1%, what does that actually work out to in terms of real people?
In the period that we're talking about, the total number of death sentences was 7,482, or in rough numbers, 7,500. 4% of that is about 300 defendants, of whom a few over 100 were actually exonerated. So what this means is that in this period, about twice as many defendants as were exonerated and released were also left unexonerated on death row or elsewhere in the prison system.
Now, you've also said that 4.1% is actually a conservative estimate?
Right. We think that's our judgment, yes.
How so?
The main reason is that the process of identifying innocent people by execution, excuse me, the main reason is that the process of identifying innocent defendants by exoneration is not perfect. And as a result, there are going to be some defendants who were not identified, who would be innocent if we knew all the facts that could possibly be known about the case, but will probably never be known in reality. There is primarily, given the way the analysis is done, defendants who will remain on death row for longer than 21 years and very likely die on death row from disease or old age or suicide. That number also includes some number of defendants who were innocent and executed. Both of those groups are not ones that are included in our estimate. On the other side, there are very likely some defendants who were exonerated who were not innocent. But because there is a much larger group from which to draw errors in the direction of excluding innocent people, it's our judgment that this is a conservative estimate. We intentionally tried to construct the procedure we use to produce a realistic but conservative estimate, and I think we have done so.
Would DNA identification technology have any impact on these numbers?
It will, but not much. DNA identification is available to determine guilt or innocence primarily in rape cases. What DNA identification does is show that a biological sample at the scene of a crime was left by a particular person. And sometimes that's extremely telling, especially if the biological sample is semen that was recovered from the body of a victim. And that does happen in some capital cases, in rape murder cases, where the victim was raped and where there is a strong reason to believe that semen or other bodily fluids found in or on the body of the deceased person came from the killer. But there aren't very many of those cases. Of all the exonerations in capital cases in the United States since 1973, it's a total of, I believe, 131 now, only 18 have any DNA evidence involved. And the reason is that most murders and most capital murders don't include the type of biological physical evidence that could be used for DNA analysis. So in rape cases, yes, I think DNA technology has made a big difference and increased the accuracy of criminal convictions quite a bit. In murder cases and capital cases, only to a slight extent.
Well, now, what's the practical application for this research?
As a researcher, actually, the thing that's most exciting to me and to my colleagues is that it was possible to come up with any estimate, any reasonable valid estimate of the rate of false convictions for any well-defined set of crimes, because the general wisdom in the field has been that that's a figure that is not only unknown, but essentially unknowable, that we can't say how frequent false convictions are. We just know that's like seeing the far side of the moon. It's just not accessible to us. But in this context, given the amount of information we have and the structure of the process, it turns out we can come up with an estimate, and it's rather higher than I think we expected. Is a point of light in a context in which, in general, our ignorance is pervasive. In the context of the death penalty, it tells us that we make quite a few mistakes, really a surprising number. One consequence of that is that it seems all but certain, given the number of cases we're talking about, that some of the people that have been erroneously convicted and sentenced to death have been executed, but we can't identify who they are.
Sam, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And we've linked to Samuel R. Gross and his recent research on the rate of false convictions and the death penalty on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. After the break, we'll speak to psychiatrist Dr. James C. Harris about the intersection of capital punishment and intellectual disability.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at the social and biological science of female sex organs. We'll talk to Dr. Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center Institute for Regenerative Medicine, about the creation and use of lab-grown vaginas. Biology professor Marie Haberstein exposes the bias against female genitalia in scientific studies. And science writer Emily Anthes tells us about the history and promising future of female condoms. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. This week, we're discussing the death penalty and what science can tell us about how it's applied. My next guest is Dr. James C. Harris, and Dr. Harris is the founding director of the Developmental Neuropsychiatry Program and past director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. As a member of the Neurodevelopmental Committee, he was lead author for the DSM-5 definition of intellectual disability or intellectual developmental disorder. Dr. Harris also provided consultation to the American Psychiatric Association legal department in preparing an amicus brief to the United States Supreme Court in the death penalty case Hall versus Florida. Thanks very much for being here, James.
Well, good morning.
Now, as I said in your introduction, you were the lead author of the DSM-5 definition of intellectual developmental disorders. So could you maybe give us some background on the need to create that definition in the first place?
Well, I think that first it's important to know that the DSM, or the Diagnostic Manual, that's used by the American Psychiatric Association and adapted in many other countries, is revised periodically based on new evidence and continuing study. The last revision was in 1994, and there had been considerable new research during those years, so it was decided the manual would be revised and harmonized with the next edition of the International Classification of Diseases from the World Health Organization. What we sought to do was to better characterize mental disorders with the goal of providing better services. And the reason that we made changes in intellectual developmental disorder, or intellectual disability, as it's often referred to, is that the classification periodically has to be changed, not only for medical and research reasons, but also because of the way the definition is used in society. And the names for children and adults with these types of problems have been used pejoratively over the years, you remember the terms moron, imbecile, and idiot. The term mental retardation was introduced as a neutral term in 1961, and by the end of the 20th century, it had been what people sometimes call the R word, which was referred to someone as a retard. That being the case, there was a campaign to end the word and to make a different usage. And in the medical and the psychological literature, a new term, intellectual disability, became the most commonly used. In the state of Maryland, a young woman, a 9-year-old girl with Down syndrome, was being called retard, and it made her quite upset. Her parents went to the state assembly in Maryland, and the Maryland General Assembly changed the name to intellectual disability. And our senator in Maryland, Senator Mikulski, promised the young girl's mother that if the state of Maryland changed their definition and their terminology, that she would go to the U.S. Senate and to Congress. And Senator Mikulski did. So as a result, Rosa's Law was passed in the U.S., and all federal legislation in the U.S. that previously used the term mental retardation now uses the term intellectual disability.
But even that phrase is problematic in itself, is it not?
Well, it's problematic because it's a dilemma, because these names over time can be misused. Intellectual disability refers to the term someone having a disability. Now, disability is important because a disability leads to services for individuals. What we did in DSM-5 in conjunction with the name change that's proposed for the International Classification of Diseases, ICD-11, is we put in parentheses intellectual developmental disorder.
Right.
And the new name in the International Classification of Diseases will be disorders of intellectual development. The focus continually is on trying to focus on the type of problem that we need to remediate and to help compensate for. And we think that focused on this is a developmental disorder, like the other neurodevelopmental disorders, which include reading problems and math problems, and so on, is a way for people to understand that we need to treat everyone at the level of their abilities and understanding and their capacities. And so a problem in intellectual development, we feel, is probably the least biased type of terminology that can be used, and I think the most understandable. The term mental retardation has been based on a statistical context, based on standard deviations from mean scores on intelligence tests. And although that's been a very helpful way to help people be placed in proper educational classes, it's not been sufficient when you think about how we adapt in the real world. So what we have done is placed more emphasis in DSM-5 on adaptive functioning, and we focused on adaptive reasoning, how someone uses their intelligence to adapt in social situations, in academic situations, and in practical situations. And by doing that, we've shifted the focus away from IQ cutoff scores when we talk about severity to basically to descriptions of how a person adapts when their social demands, when their conceptual demands, and when there are practical decisions to be made and practical problems to be solved. And in that way, we're describing the person who's adapting in the world and may need additional supports to allow them to master problems and to solve them. But as we say in DSM-5, an IQ test, which focuses primarily on conceptual understandings, is not sufficient when one deals with social situations and some practical situations. The IQ tests were designed originally to focus on academic reasoning rather than social reasoning. And it's social reasoning that becomes particularly important when we deal with problems that have to do with the legal system.
And specifically the death penalty. Now, you actually came to my attention through all the media around Freddie Lee Hall. Can you tell us a bit about his case, just an overview?
Yeah, well, Freddie Lee Hall is someone who was involved in a serious crime with the Confederate. They kidnapped a woman from a store, took her car, drove her to a wooded area, raped and killed her. Then they returned, and when it became evident that something had happened that was suspicious, the police became involved, and they killed a policeman. Hall was given the death penalty decision, and the person with him was given life because it was claimed that Hall was an instigator to this event. So he's been on death row for essentially 30 years. And when the new decision came about in 2002, and remember it was only 2002 in the Atkins decision in the U.S., when the death penalty was considered cruel and unusual punishment under the U.S. Constitution's Eighth Amendment, that it became illegal, essentially, to execute people, or as they say, make them eligible for the death penalty. And the reasoning for that was that people with an intellectual deficit have difficulties in understanding the consequences of their actions and in making decisions when they're under stress, having an adaptive way of using their intelligence to consider alternatives. And when that happens, they are considered now by the courts to be mitigating circumstances and to reduce their culpability in the capital crime. And this was the case with Hall because it was testified in court and generally agreed in the various testimonies that he had been mentally retarded for his entire life since his childhood. However, because the focus on the definitions was on an IQ score, the IQ score was given precedence, and since his IQ was tested several times over 70, the mitigating circumstance, which was his adaptive behavior, was not fully considered.
This is Science for the People, and I'm speaking with Dr. James C. Harris, the lead author for the DSM-5 definition for intellectual disability. Now, Hall's IQ had been tested a number of times with different results, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And testing IQ is problematic in itself.
Well, that's true, because the IQ test essentially is a test that's not a specific number, because there's a standard error of measurement, since when people are tested, the circumstances change, the circumstances make a difference, how they interact with the interviewer who's doing the test makes a difference. Their alertness during the test makes a difference. So the test is viewed as an IQ number with a standard error of measurement, which is approximately 5 points each way. So that would mean that a test between 65 and 75 would be the range that one would consider for intellectual disability. The issue in the case in Florida and in several other U.S. states is that rather than accept the standard error of measurement, which is done in the majority of the states, they set a bright line IQ of 70. And not only did they set a bright line IQ of 70, but rather than understanding that adaptive reasoning is the overall construct, and that there really isn't a prong one and a prong two, but there's an interrelated problem in intellectual functioning and adaptive functioning. Instead, in the case of Florida, they said they accepted a bright line IQ number, and the inquiry ended at that point. What that meant was that even if the person had severe adaptive problems and adaptive reasoning and problem solving and social understanding, that couldn't be considered by the court because the only thing that really was the focus was whether or not the IQ was above or below the number 70. In the Supreme Court decision that followed, Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority of opinion, said that intellectual disability is a condition, not a number. And I think that's probably one of the most succinct statements that has been part of this case. So what has happened by looking at this and understanding that IQ is not a fixed number, that a number cannot be used to define a human being, that one needs to look at the individual's capacities. And in most cases, if not all, neuropsychological testing is done to look at the various intellectual functionings. So what happened in this case was they accepted a number that was never meant to be a single number, but a range of scores. And they tested him a number of times. But we have to keep in mind that he was tested early on. He was tested throughout the years. And the most recent test that had been done found an IQ of 71, which made him eligible for the death penalty. So the issue was that they were focusing on retesting, and the retesting in itself prove the variability of an IQ test score without taking into account the essential thing, which is adaptive functioning, his adaptive reasoning in the areas that I've mentioned.
So what was the court's ruling then?
The Supreme Court's ruling was the state of Florida's use of a bright line IQ number was unconstitutional. And it was unconstitutional because it was not in keeping with the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution of the U.S. The Eighth Amendment was a formal amendment to the Constitution that was focused on human dignity, and that people who may have created crimes as human beings needed to be appreciated as people. That human dignity required that they be given every opportunity to defend themselves. And of course, if they were a mitigating circumstance, like intellectual disability, then their culpability was not as great as someone else who understood cognitively their actions more fully.
So how exactly did the Supreme Court use the DSM-5?
Well, I think there's several examples where they used quotations from DSM-5 that were in the American Psychiatric Association amicus brief. And the one that they highlight is this: a person with an IQ score above 70 may have such severe adaptive behavior problems that the person's actual functioning is comparable to that of an individual with a lower IQ score.
So where does Hall specifically stand now?
Well, where Hall now stands is that the Supreme Court has declared the bright line IQ unconstitutional and sent it back to the state of Florida to reconsider the case. And in reconsidering the case, the way the opinion's written, the state of Florida will have to take into account his adaptive functioning and his adaptive reasoning in making the final determination.
Now, how exactly does that look? Because I understand that it's much easier just to state some arbitrary number and it's above or below that, and that's fairly easy. But how do you determine adaptive functioning in this case?
Well, let me just say first, the number isn't exactly arbitrary because it's based on a on very refined intelligence testing that has a range. So the test is useful, and in the text we require that intelligence testing be done, but we require that it be done along with assessment of adaptive functioning. And adaptive functioning is, let me just give you some examples of adaptive functioning. So, for example, intellectual disability involves impairments of general mental abilities that impact adaptive functioning in three areas. And these determine how well the individual copes in everyday life. The conceptual domain includes skills in language, reading, math, reasoning, knowledge, and memory. Social domain refers to empathy, social judgment, interpersonal communication skills, the ability to make and retain friendships and similar activities. The practical domain focuses on self-management in areas such as personal care, job responsibilities, money management, recreation, organizing school and work tasks. So what we have done is we focused on what it means to adapt in everyday life and how one uses reasoning and judgment. And what we have done in the definition, and this is important that we include, is for the first time in DSM-5, we have a definition of intelligence, a generally agreed upon definition of intelligence that's included in the definition. In the past, mental retardation was considered to be a contributing factor in mental illnesses and was listed on in a multi-axial classification on Axis 2. It wasn't a mainline focused diagnosis in DSM-4. And so we've moved intellectual disability is a mental disorder just like other mental disorders. And the rationale for that is in the paper that I sent you, which is from the WHO, which describes how by shifting the DSM-5 to include neurodevelopmental disorders and neurocognitive disorders, and neurocognitive disorders basically are dementia, Alzheimer's disease. So if we include disorders that have to do with neurocognitive functioning, in one end of the spectrum, then we need to include it in the other end of the spectrum. And this is why there's a difference in DSM-5 from DSM-4, because we now have a category called neurodevelopmental disorders that didn't exist in DSM-4.
James, thank you very much for joining us to explain all of this. You'll find links to Dr. James C. Harris and more information about IQ and the death penalty on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.